Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Risk.
And it is just the two of us today.
Just the two of us.
No guest. It is spring break at Notre Dame and spring break next week for you at IUSB.
That's true.
So kind of chill vibes today, I think.
Very.
Yeah. Very chill.
Very chill.
I do want to talk about something specific today, but I thought we could chat for just a minute. How are you doing?
Great.
Before we started recording, I just made fun of him for talking quite a bit, and now you're not talking. So
no, I don't talk at all.
No?
Never.
Are you reading, watching, or listening to anything interesting right now?
Yes. Yes. As you know, I was down with a cold for the last few days.
Knocked out.
It's fine now. Mm-hmm. You might hear a little bit in my voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been watching one of your recommended shows.
Yes, finally.
What do you mean finally? Well, I only realized now that I had access to it, because before that I didn't have access to it. And it's this show called Yellow Jackets.
Yeah, Yellow Jackets. Great show.
Great show.
Nothing to do with science.
I mean, no.
No.
Not really. I mean, science is everywhere.
That's true. I'm sure we can find some science in there.
Chemistry is everything. Yeah.
But yeah, Yellow Jackets.
Great show. Really, really good. What's it about? It's about a group of high school students, a girls' soccer team, to be precise.
In the 90s.
1996, I believe, is when it's set, 95 or 96. Mm-hmm. And they are traveling by plane, and then the plane crashes, and they end up in the wilderness in like some sort of northern wilderness, probably like in Canada.
Canada
somewhere. From the United States, and they end up in Canada in the wilderness, and they just... madness ensues. It's very... and then it kind of flashes back and forth between... present day being like 2021 or 2022.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So like 25 years later, essentially, after they are supposed to graduate from high school. And you don't know who survived and who didn't.
Yeah, it's a lot of...
it's a lot of drama. Yeah.
And great show.
Great show. Really great characters. And also, I think the music is amazing because that's around the time that I graduated from high school.
Yeah.
So I'm basically the same age as the characters in present day.
Right, right.
And so the music is just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters are amazing. They're very deep and, you know, and I could not stop watching it when I was sick. And now, and then I, of course, had all kinds of crazy dreams because it's like a kind of a suspense show.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Psychological suspense.
Yeah, it's great. I'm excited you're finally watching it.
Yeah.
So, recommendation from chemistry professor Dr. Shahir Risk to watch Yellow Jacket.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah.
Well,
and I'm not really reading much.
No. No reading.
Emails.
Yeah.
A lot of emails. I feel like I blink and I get like 20 emails.
Yeah.
And I'm not that important. Like, why are you emailing me that much?
That's true. I was just re-listening to an episode we recorded that came out today with Michelle Thaler, and she was talking about how 80% of what scientists do is actually like really boring administrative stuff.
Yes.
Like lots of emails and meetings and budgets, and that's kind of what you've been doing too.
Yeah. Luckily, I wouldn't say it's 80% of what I do because I like a lot of what I do. But
because you also teach.
But... yeah. And I enjoy a lot of that. And teaching for me, because we're predominantly teaching university, teaching takes the majority of my time. And I happen to really enjoy it. It's exhausting, but it's wonderful and it's very rewarding.
Yeah.
But, you know, the rest of the time it's just emails and research and grants and whatever.
Grading. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I want to talk about something else that you do as part of your job, but I do also want to take just a moment, which I think we'll probably address this in other episodes. It is currently a crazy time to be a scientist.
Very
in
crazy.
The United States.
Yes.
So some of the things we've discussed in previous episodes were happening prior to a lot of what's going on with funding and NIH and NSF and all those things. So the tone and flavor of some of our conversations might shift a little bit in light of this. And I think it's fair to acknowledge that scientists are a bit, I don't know the right word for it. Lots of stress, fear, uncertainty as a scientist in the world right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if you are somebody funded by some of these agencies like the NIH and, right. and the like. And grad students in particular, kind of stressed out. Lots of hiring freezes.
Yeah.
And, you know, resending acceptances to graduate school at the moment for some universities. So
it's really unprecedented.
It really is.
Yeah. It's not the first time that we've gone through a process where there is some sort of hiring freezes. You know, we've gone through a recession. I was a postdoc during the recession in 2008. And the attitude was just hang in there and wait for the economy to get better.
And transitions from administrations, there's always some kind of changes and pauses and everything.
Yeah.
When a new administration takes over. But this is pretty unprecedented.
Absolutely.
For anybody who's currently in science. So,
yeah, it does feel like we don't know what is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this, I'm only just kind of talking about, and again, none of our views, I think it goes without saying that our personal views don't reflect any of the people who are supporting us or any of the organizations that are supporting us.
Yeah.
And we also don't necessarily agree with or disagree with any of the opinions or the stances of the organizations that fund us. And so I think it goes without saying.
Yeah.
So I think it's a lot of people are like, well, let's just kind of try to pretend like business as usual, but in the back of our head, we are trying to prepare for something that we don't know. It's like the unknown unknown. We have no idea what's going on. Or the known unknown. Mm-hmm. We know that there's something, but we don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just don't know if they're going to have a job by the end of the year, by the end of the month even.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hitting international students very, very hard.
Yes, yes. One of our dear friends is an international student.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Scary time.
It is very scary. And it's really messed up a lot of his timelines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that this is really people's futures here. So
yeah, it's people's futures, jobs, even people who work at universities who aren't graduate students or scientists, they're impacted by this as well, because some of the support for running large buildings and everything comes from federal money as well.
Exactly.
So I think we like to keep this show fun and lighthearted and keep things, show that scientists are normal and have fun. But I think it's important to acknowledge that this is currently going on. And talking to people outside of academic institutions and people who aren't scientists, I think a lot of people don't know what's going on and what some of these headlines and decisions mean for people that they know and love.
Yes.
So,
And it's not just about the people. You know, people are the most important thing, of course, but also by extension, the people, as in everybody in the world who benefits from science.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, again, science is great. It's wonderful. But ultimately, it's about the people who do the science, their journey, but also the people who benefit from it being basically everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all in this together, really.
Yeah.
We're all in this together.
And so
it's tough.
It is. And so I agree with some of the things you've said of, well, we should just keep doing what we're doing while we can do it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Go back to your labs and do the work while we can. That doesn't mean that you're ignoring what's going on, but that's what we're trained to do, is to do the research.
And I will extend that even more. I will use this platform to, you know, make a pitch to all the scientists that are out there. I will say, I understand that you're very angry, you might be, or frustrated, you might be. I would like to challenge you to go and find that one relative that you disagree with. You know who I'm talking about, right? That maybe more than one relative that you disagree with on all the policies and all the politics, and just reach out to them and try to be nice to them. And try to actually listen to them and see what they really care about. Because if there is a perception in some communities that scientists are just wasting money or that we're indoctrinating your kids or whatever it is that we do in college campuses, it is really our responsibility to change that perception. And we can't do that with shouting matches. We can only do that with making a real effort to find our shared humanity, because we all want the same thing. We all want better communities. We want safety for our children, and we want them to grow up to be amazing. And, you know, these are all things we can all unite on. Mm-hmm. We might disagree on how to do it. And so trying to understand each other by building these relationships, I think, is going to be really the best way to move forward. And no policy or politician is going to change the perception of scientists in the communities. Only we can do that. Mm-hmm. That's my message, I should say.
I support this message.
Oh, no. Oh,
no. Now I think...
Now it sounded like a political ad. I support this message.
Well,
which is the opposite of what I wanted to do.
No, I think currently we do have a lot of scientists who listen and support this, and so we're very grateful. So this is our pitch to you to to think. As you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, this is one of the first times that some of these changes that come with the new administration really feel scary and a lot of uncertainty. And I think there's a lot of people in our communities who maybe have opposite views from us, but are operating from a same sense of fear and uncertainty.
Right.
That maybe doesn't make sense to us about why they would be scared or afraid of something that maybe we don't think is real or isn't a valid concern. And so now here we are as scientists facing some of those same feelings of fear and uncertainty, and our neighbors might not understand why we feel that way. So right. It's an opportunity to realize that people are operating from the same kinds of emotions and to find some commonality that people are afraid, and they can maybe do things that wouldn't make sense to us.
Right.
So go talk to people around you. Touch grass.
Yeah.
Have a beer with your neighbor.
Or coffee.
And just get out there. So I don't want to be a Debbie Downer too much.
No. We really have to find our shared humanity. That's the message. I think it's really important that we do that. And I hope that doesn't get lost in the rhetoric and the slogans.
Yeah. And I think that actually kind of ties in nicely to what I actually hope we can talk about today, which is a little bit more lighthearted and fun, I think.
Hopefully.
We wrote a book.
Did we?
I think we did.
Oh, my goodness.
And we have mentioned it on some episodes before, but I thought it would be nice to do an episode where we talk a little bit more about the book, some of the motivations, inspirations, and maybe share some bits about the book with our listeners. It is going to be released, May 13th. So this is currently March. So hopefully when you hear this, the book is already out.
Yeah.
So I want to talk to you specifically and kind of hear your experience writing the book and your motivation. And I've got a bunch of questions that I'll probably never get to ask, because you'll you'll take it all different directions. What is this book? What is the title of it and the subtitle?
The book is called The Color of North.
Yeah.
The Color of North is the title of the book. And it has some sort of long subtitle.
Yeah, I don't remember. I do remember many emails being sent back and forth about the title and subtitle.
Yes. The title is The Color of North.
Yes.
And it is a book about something that we are very passionate about. It's about proteins. But it's really not about proteins also.
I don't think it's as much about proteins as I initially thought it was. I think you're right.
Yeah. It's really, and the motivation here is that, you know, a long time ago, I got really excited about learning about proteins when I saw what they looked like. Mm-hmm. They looked like modern art. They looked like these really cool, almost like Celtic knots. Mm-hmm. And I got really fascinated. And it's one thing to look at something that is fantastic and abstract that is not real. And it's another thing to look at something that is that looks like abstract art, but it's actually real and mm-hmm. it does something. Mm-hmm. And I've never really forgotten that feeling of the joy of learning about proteins as biomolecules, as catalysts for life, as, you know, the really the worker bees of the cell. They do almost everything that we want to do to accomplish the task of being alive.
Mm-hmm.
And not just us, but every living thing and every living thing that's ever lived that we know of. And it's that place of joy that I came back to. And I think it's very exclusive sometimes to learn about science. Science mm-hmm. can be very exclusive because you really have to have the privilege to be able to learn. And especially in this country, it costs money to go to college mm-hmm. for most people. So it's difficult to get there. And I think what we wanted to do with this book is to make learning accessible and make learning about a fun topic accessible to a general audience, meaning that you really don't have to know a whole lot about science in the first place, let alone protein science.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you tell me, Maggie, how are we actually doing that in our book, The Color of North?
Well, now you're getting ahead of my question.
Oh, yeah. I kind of knew that I was going to do that.
Well, the book is... Man, now, yeah, to answer this, there's a lot of parts to it. I think what we tried to do from really the beginning of writing this book was to write it from a place of deep personal experiences that we've had, and to use those personal experiences that really highlight universal human experiences and use those as the gateway to start talking about more complex ideas about biochemistry and proteins and biology and chemistry, and tell stories and not trick people, but get people hooked into a story that then they're able to engage with content because they're coming from a different place than just than trying to get information.
Right. Yeah.
And that's not exactly how the idea of the book started necessarily, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember, you kind of had this idea for writing a book in like maybe 2018?
Yeah.
Like late 2018?
Yeah. I thought there really needs to be a book about proteins because there's a lot of books out there about DNA and genes and,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's really great.
Mm-hmm.
But proteins as biomolecules have been really underexplored mm-hmm. and maybe glossed over. People go from genes and DNA straight to cells and then, mm-hmm. you know, microorganisms
right.
or ecology.
Right.
Those are a lot of the popular science books that are out there. And it just seemed like there was a gap.
Yeah.
And being a protein scientist, I was like, you know, somebody really needs to tell stories
mm-hmm.
about these really awesome
mm-hmm.
things. But that was not really the initial motivation. I think I wanted to just write a book of information.
Yeah.
the way that I would teach a biochemistry course.
Right. Which is how a lot of, you know, even though they're supposed to be popular science books, that's kind of how a lot of them end up reading. They can be kind of dense, even if they are meant for a broader audience that isn't trained in that specialty. So I remember you talking about this book idea. We were not working on it together when you initially had this idea, if I remember. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, it's true.
I was doing other stuff.
Yeah.
And then what happened? Because my memory of this is different than yours. So I don't remember.
You know, we make up memories just as much as we pretend that the future is real.
Mm-hmm.
And I just get really philosophical here. We really make stuff up all the time. But mm-hmm. if I remember, I think I was going to write a very boring book about proteins.
I don't know about that.
No, it's true. And I was looking out there to see if there are any books about proteins, boring or non-boring. Mm-hmm. And there really wasn't much. It was not zero, but it was pretty close to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing really felt like this is the kind of information that I want to put out there in the sphere mm-hmm. of things. And then at the time, the two of us were working in the lab together.
Mm-hmm.
And you happened to be taking a writing class.
I was taking a writing class.
And it ended up being an... It ended up being an illustrated...
It was like a graphic memoir.
Graphic memoir kind of class. And I saw some of your artwork and just the angle that you had on telling stories. And it really started with one very specific comic strip that you made.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about how proteins are like your friends. And you pick different proteins and how each one has a property that is similar to some properties that we might find in our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so proteins like antibodies, for example. Antibodies, of course, are our body's way of fighting against foreign invasions, so mm-hmm. viruses or bacteria or any infection. And you drew a really beautiful structure of an antibody, which is like a Y shape with mm-hmm. really nice watercolors. And you said some of them are, you know, some proteins are like, some friends are like antibodies because they're always fighting. You know, they're basically helping you out mm-hmm. in a fight. So that was the theme. And you picked each protein for one of these properties. And I think it was fascinating to me as a scientist because I started seeing proteins in a different light. This anthropomorphization, if you will. Did I say it right?
I think so.
Yeah. Making them seem like humans. How about that? It was so pronounced, you know, and obvious. It's obvious that proteins are not people. But when you do that, it really comes up. And then I can really start thinking about the properties that these proteins have or the functions that they do. But you were doing this for a class that was basically a bunch of non-scientists. In fact, I think you were the only scientist in the class.
Yeah.
So what was the reaction when you wrote this kind of stuff? Like, here is a thing that you've never heard of. These are called proteins and they have these beautiful structures. And here I am drawing them and giving them properties like friends. What was the reaction in the class?
Yeah, I do remember this very vividly because I was kind of nervous to share this piece with the class. We had to get up and present it and read it and show the artwork. And immediately, everyone had their hand raised and had questions. The professor was super interested and had never seen anything like that. And a lot of people were like, is that really what they look like?
Yeah.
Is that really what proteins look like? Which, yes and no, that they...
It's a representation of what they look like.
It's a representation of what they look like. And but the idea of the different shapes and structures they can have is true. And it was really interesting to see people who... I think most of them were probably English majors or something, you know, in a more...
liberal arts, humanities, yeah.
Be really interested in science. At that point, I hadn't done anything about science for any of my assignments or pieces. So it was the first time I'd done that and to see them engage with it in a way that was... Clearly, they understood what I wanted them to understand, and they had more questions, right? Anytime you give any type of talk and people have questions, that's a good sign.
Yeah, that means they're interested, yeah?
Yeah, and they have followed along enough to be able to ask a question. So it was really exciting, and I just kind of did it for fun at the time. I didn't really think too much of it, and I must have then shown it to you. I don't remember, honestly.
Yeah, you did. And it's interesting that you say that you were a little bit nervous about sharing that part of your life. Sometimes it is actually tricky because you don't know how people are going to receive it. Because mm-hmm. in a way, and this really kind of goes back to how isolated sometimes scientists can be. We're in the lab. We study these things. We know them so well and so little at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That we have these, that they're almost like friends and sometimes they're enemies and sometimes they're frenemies and you don't know what's going to happen, whether it's proteins or bacteria that you're studying or mosquitoes mm-hmm. or the ecosystem. And it's just, it's always a puzzle, but it's always this familiar.
Yeah, you thing develop that you a have. Relationship with whatever you're working with.
Right. But then it's very difficult to kind of share that with the rest of the world because you don't know how it's going to be received. Don't get me wrong. Scientists love to talk about their science.
Yeah.
But to do it in such an artistic way where, you know, in a way, as scientists, we're told not to do that.
Right.
You know, be objective, present the data, don't anthropomorphize, right? Because we know that proteins are not people. And so so doing that kind of, it makes you a little bit nervous. And I'm wondering if that makes sense, or if that was the feeling that you had.
Yeah, I think to talk about science in that way and to have fun with it and to kind of make it a little bit, excuse me, silly, was one of the reasons I was nervous, because you kind of are really taught to not behave that way around your science, even though scientists all secretly are doing it in their labs.
Yeah, we're all big dorks, and we just, it is true. That's like the biggest secret, that scientists are portrayed to be like these very serious thing, blah, 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 blah. But we're just like mischievous people who are just trying to play around. And that's, you know, you learn through play in a sense.
Right, right.
You experiment.
Right? Yeah, it's exactly right. I don't know. It almost kind of felt like shattering the glass a little bit, like letting people kind of actually
letting them in.
Yeah. And not knowing if it would work, if people would get it, what I was trying to do. And I think in another format, it wouldn't have worked. Mm-hmm. But this specific art format we were working in, this idea worked really well. Even though I still haven't like shown anybody else this piece of artwork yet, really at all, which you keep bugging me about.
Yeah, you should definitely share it with the rest of the world.
And then it was also, I think part of the reason I don't really share it with anybody else currently is I don't know how scientists would receive it either.
Yeah, and that's a different thing. But I think the bottom line here is that this really was a bit of a catalyst to kind of really, you know, I had this idea of I want to write a book, and you brought in the idea of proteins in art form and kind of like a comic strip, and then the book ended up kind of somewhere in between.
Yeah, I would say
so. Yeah. And so let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, I don't really remember when or how I ended up coming. We came to start working on the book together because, you know, when I made that piece of art, I was not thinking about your book project at all.
Yeah.
And you had started to write bits and pieces of it, and that was really great. And I, so I don't know what happened, but we ended up, you said, look, you want to do it with me, I guess. It's probably
happened. And that's what I did. I said,
and I don't remember that conversation.
I said, you know, that protein science is really a very visual
form,
right?
Yes.
Because protein structures are very three-dimensional. And I had not really drawn anything for years and years and years. So the idea of drawing something seemed daunting.
Mm-hmm.
But you really encouraged me to actually do some more drawing. And so we ended up illustrating the book ourselves.
We did, yeah.
We did.
They're all hand-drawn.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that you did more than I did, I think we did it together a couple times, is specifically for the illustrations and even generating some of the topics for the book, is we participated in a thing called Inktober.
Yes, Inktober.
Which is, for anybody who's not aware, it's this hashtag during the month of October where there's many different forms of them, of these Inktober things, some of them different prompts. But every day there's a different prompt for you to draw something,
right,
and post it online.
Yeah.
So I think you had done one.
Yeah, I was doing one, I think, in 2018.
Yeah, so you were drawing proteins before.
I was. I took so the themes, and this is for everybody, but the themes, you know, they just use one word, and then you have to draw something that resembles that. And I just tried to come up with a protein that resembles something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, when one of the words was, let's say, blood, I drew the structure of red blood cells and hemoglobin, which is the protein that resides in the red blood cells. Mm-hmm. and carries iron, but it also uses it to carry oxygen around.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just write a little bit about it. And I think people really kind of reacted to that. They liked the shapes, and they liked the idea of connecting something like blood to a protein that's, that lives in our blood.
Right.
Same thing with like toxin, I think I drew, or like poison, I think I drew something like a scorpion and the scorpion venom protein, protein that's in the scorpion venom. It's a fun, really little structure that I did. And it was all just ink drawings. And that's what ended up being in the book, is mostly ink drawings. Yeah. And some of them actually came from the original Inktober prompt.
If you go to your Instagram page, they're probably on there.
They're probably on there still, yeah.
So, and then we did that, I think, for a couple more years after that. We do that every October, because the timeline here, for people who maybe weren't paying attention, we started this in 2019.
Yeah.
And it is currently 2025.
It is.
And the book is coming out. So this has been, I don't know what that math's up to, but
it's been a
five,
lot.
6 years of doing this.
Yes.
So we had a lot of time to generate ideas and content.
For sure.
And so obviously the illustrated part of it, kind of we can pinpoint where that came from. But then the writing style, I feel like, shifted quite a bit as well. And from my perspective, some of the inspiration for that was a book called Braiding Sweetgrass.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what year I read it and gave it to you. We read it basically.
Yeah, you gave it to me right after your...
At the same time. It's a book by a scientist. Her name is Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's an indigenous woman and a botanist.
Yes.
And so she wrote this really beautiful book. And at the time, it wasn't quite as big as it is now. But right now, it's probably a New York Times bestseller, like quite a popular book.
And if you're listening right now, we would love to interview you, Professor Robin Wall Kimmerer. You're welcome to come.
I think I read it in about 2018. So probably around this, clearly this was on our minds, I think, around this time. But the way she wrote, not only is she just an incredible writer.
Yeah, yes.
Her prose is just moving, brilliant, emotional. But then she used these really personal stories of her life to talk about scientific ideas around botany and sustainability and environmentalism. So it's stuff within her field. And I just knew that when we started writing this book that I wanted to write like that, to talk about science like that.
Yeah, this was certainly an inspiration.
It's like the writing was just incredible. And I've read a lot. I'm a big reader and I've read a lot of pop science books. And I'd never read anything quite like that, and the way that she was so unscientific in the way she talked about so much and loose with it, right?
Yes.
And I think a lot of that had to do with also talking about her indigenous culture and the way that they approach science, which is a very different idea of understanding the world and having knowledge of things than our traditional scientific methods. So I thought that was super bold and interesting as well. And I wanted to, if we were going to write a book, I wanted to write something that was similar in tone to that, because it just doesn't exist out there, especially for a woman scientist to write that way.
Yeah.
It was really inspirational to me. And thankfully, you were like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, definitely. I was totally on board.
One of the first parts of our book that got written is still probably my favorite part of the book.
Oh, no.
So it's the opening chapter of the book, and you're writing about your grandmother. And cooking with her in Egypt when you were growing up.
Yes.
I still remember the first time I read it. And it almost makes me emotional. It's so beautifully written. And I was like, yes, this is what we need to do. And for those of you who have never written a book, your editor basically destroys everything you try to write. but that section, it got changed and is essentially what you wrote 5 years ago.
Yeah, very little edits. And we got to give credit to our editor.
Oh, we have a wonderful editor. She did not destroy all our stuff.
No, not at all. She was so encouraging.
And
I think she got it as soon as we sent her a draft. She totally got it.
Yeah.
Our editor and our agent. And they knew exactly what we were going for.
Because that was
what they pushed us.
that chapter you wrote, right? The rest of the chapter we talk. I'll go into more, but that's what we sent out to editors and publishers, and I think that speaks to the whole tone of the book and your ability to capture something very human, and then to go on to talk about proteins. And, you know, that first chapter is kind of an introduction and talk about antifreeze proteins and just kind of some very basic ideas about what proteins are without going into too much detail to not overwhelm the reader. So if any reader reads that book, at least make it through the first chapter. It's the best one, in my opinion.
Well, I don't know.
And so I think that also reading Braiding Sweetgrass and kind of, you know, you've always been an excellent writer. You're a published poet. You've written a lot of really beautiful pieces. So clearly your writing ability was there to write both scientifically and then also to write in this more, I don't know how to describe it, but prose kind of way that's not commonly found when talking about scientific ideas, even to the general public. So your ability to do that, I think, really helped propel the book into a different place, and thankfully people were interested in hearing about science in that way, and I think it speaks to the times as well and what people want. And people really want that human connection.
You know, you can't get me to stop talking about science, and 90% of my friends are not scientists.
This is true.
And they know that I love talking about science, and I can't just start by showing them graphs and plots.
No.
I can do that with you because you'll know. You'll be like, oh, yeah, you messed up.
Your friends would just be
like, yeah.
You know, they
would fall asleep before I even turn the projector on.
Yep.
So I knew very, very early on that if I wanted people to share that joy that I have about the science and the work that I study, I really had to do it in a way that they can relate to. And what better way to do it than talking about things like food? We love food on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I talk with my friends about soccer all the time because soccer is life.
Yeah.
And, you know, food, friendship, but also, you know, things like the immigrant experience.
Mm-hmm.
And in your chapter, you talk about dealing with loss and dealing with, like, aging grandparents and how that relates to neurodegenerative disorders and things like Alzheimer's and all the proteins that are just moving around and maybe not doing what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with this disease that, you know, all of us have lost somebody. All of us know someone that has suffered from some sort of disease. And a lot of these diseases, really a protein is at the heart of it. It's not doing the job that it's supposed to do. Either something we're born with that is not functioning properly, or something that we acquire from the environment that ruins a good protein.
Right.
And so I can start by talking about Alzheimer's and the plaques and the whatever and the alpha helix to the beta sheet transition and the primary and secondary tertiary quaternary secondary, blah, 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 blah. But then that's it. You've already lost your audience. But everybody loves food and family and friends and just the experience of being alive. And I think that's, again, it's about finding our shared humanity.
Yeah. And also just a slight side note. We wrote this book together. We were each... We wrote it, and we alternate chapters, basically. So you write a chapter, I write a chapter. There's a couple chapters we co-wrote.
Yes.
I don't remember.
Guys. I don't remember.
I blocked it all out. That's kind of how
a great experience.
Because, like, how do two people write a book together? That's how we decided to do it.
Yeah.
So it kind of shifts between each of our voices. Another question I kind of wanted to hear your experience about writing, because right when we were writing it together, I have no idea. I blacked out most of what was happening. It was very stressful. We wrote part of it during COVID too.
So we weren't even like seeing. We were just like resuming and texting.
Yeah, and since we did kind of write our own chapters individually, I don't really know as much about your writing and research experience, but you are a biochemist, you're a protein scientist, you teach these things, but you also had to do a lot of research for this book.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of things that you wrote about that you didn't know about before you started writing about them, I'm assuming, because yes. That was true for me as well.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to know what that process was like. Did you enjoy the task of finding these things out? And how does, right, just because you're a scientist doesn't mean you know everything. So we had to figure it out.
Well, as all of my friends know, I don't know everything. I know very little. And they will tell you that I know nothing about soccer, of course. Right?
Well,
they
you
know
don't
better.
Because you're a child.
Stop. But, you know, we really both had to do a lot of research on things that we didn't know. And it was just a joy because here I am coming in with the attitude that proteins are amazing because it's what I study. And then I dive deeper and I'm like, oh my God, they are far more amazing than what I ever thought. And one thing that really stands out, if you want an example.
I do want an example.
Really has to do with the title of the book. The title of the book is The Color of North, which kind of seems a little bit strange. What is the color of North? I mean, we don't have a color for North. It's not like it's red or green or blue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this really comes from kind of a mystery. It was a mystery for a while of how birds find their way when they're migrating.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to have some sort of a compass. And for a while, a lot of people said, well, they have some sort of like iron, you know, atoms or iron complex somewhere near their brain. So it acts kind of like a compass. But as it turns out, that's not necessarily how it works.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a lot of evidence that there's a protein that is in the back of their eyes. And what it does is that it actually acts essentially as a compass. Now, here's the thing. The way that this works is that the tiniest compasses, or one of the tiniest compasses that we can have, is a single electron. Because electrons, as we say, have a magnetic spin.
Yes.
Meaning they can, you know, if you put a magnet next to them, they would align themselves with the magnet.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, the way like, you know, you put a magnet to another one, they'll flip to basically orient themselves the right way. But if electrons are paired, they cancel each other out in a sense, right? One points one way, one points the other way. So then they're not going to be really sensitive.
Man, I haven't had to think about that in a long time.
I know, right? This is general chemistry stuff. Well, as it turns out, we don't respond to magnets in our bodies. We don't just walk by a magnet and then like immediately stick to
or get repelled across the room. That'd be fun.
We don't. I don't know, but I'm sure an amusement park would be able to design a ride. If we were magnetic, they would design a ride that would just toss you around.
I like that idea.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that's not the case because the vast majority of the electrons in our bodies are paired up. It's actually quite unusual to find these unpaired electrons. We find them in things like some metals, and that's how they are magnetic in a sense. And so this protein, which is known as a cryptochrome.
Mm.
Cryptochrome.
Why is it called crypto?
I don't know. I just listened
to something about cryptozoology today, so that's why it popped in my head.
Well, chrome is just from color.
Well, yeah, but about the crypto part, I don't know.
And cryptochromes are
found...
you should read the book. Well, the cryptochromes are actually found in a lot of organisms.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually use cryptochromes to regulate our circadian cycle, because they're really just light receptors. They receive light.
Yeah.
They receive light. And what they do in birds is a little bit different. It's a bit of a modification of what generally happens. It's different from what happens for us. Bacteria use it for something else. Plants use it to kind of like track the sunlight and grow towards it. But for birds, for migratory birds, it still absorbs light. But when it absorbs light, it uses that energy to separate two electrons apart from each other. So you have unpaired electrons, and now these electrons can line themselves up with the magnetic field of the Earth. And these proteins live in the eyes of these birds. And in fact, the idea here is that when, as they turn their heads from one side of the earth to the other, as they're flying, they are able to see a color that resembles north or south because of the function of that protein, how it's connected to their optic nerve. And so that's something that I did not know before. And I learned just doing research about the book, and it ended up being, you know, the kind of the title of the book. So that's just one of the many examples of how wild proteins can be, not just for us, but also for something like migratory birds.
Yeah, it's some of the basic things that happen that we kind of, we know birds migrate.
Yeah.
We just...
they've been doing it for a long time.
And it's because of proteins. Yeah. And I think an interesting theme of the book is that, like you said, these cryptochromes show up in all kinds of places. Even bacteria have these kind of receptors like that.
Yeah.
And nature just kind of takes them and repurposes them.
That's right.
Right. The proteins in our bodies can look identical to proteins in an alligator.
Yeah.
But they're used for two very different things sometimes. Or maybe they're used for the exact same thing.
Maybe.
Or maybe just slightly different, but the structure looks the same. And I think that's what's interesting about proteins. And one of the themes of the book that we hope people see is that proteins have been around forever.
Yeah.
And I think we got in trouble for saying this in the book. We said, like, nature is lazy.
Yes, they didn't like it when we said that nature is lazy.
Which I get, but it is kind of lazy.
Yeah, we'll say it here because we can say that.
Yeah, we can say it. nature doesn't do anything more than it has to do.
That's right. It's kind of like my kids.
Yeah.
Kind of like me, actually. Kind of like most people I know.
Yeah, so
I don't have to do anything and I don't have to do.
Do the bare minimum to function.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's like, this already kind of works, but if I just make this one little change, it'll do something else.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It'll do it okay. It won't be like that great.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. So
and nature is really good at that.
Nature's very good at that.
So it's about retooling all these proteins so that the same a very similar cryptochrome that works in plants to seek light works in us to regulate circadian rhythm. And it works in plant and migratory birds so that they can see colors that we can't even conceive of.
Yeah. That is a really beautiful part of the book. What chapter is that in? Is that chapter, the sensing chapter?
Three.
Yeah.
Chapter three.
That's another really beautiful chapter about how we interact with the world around us, how all organisms interact with their environment and perceive information.
Right. In very different ways.
In very different ways. There's, my favorite bacteria also can sense things and respond to their environment.
What is your favorite bacteria?
What is my favorite bacteria? Well, I can tell you what it's not right now.
Oh, man.
It's actually, E. coli is not my favorite right now because it's been difficult for me.
E. coli has been difficult for
you?
I'm
not happy with E. coli.
Mm-hmm. You're doing some molecular biology, aren't you?
Yeah, so when we clone in labs. So
you're cloning? Oh, my
cloning.
Gosh.
when we're trying to make mutations in bacteria, we usually use E. coli to essentially make that DNA for us.
Right.
And sometimes E. coli doesn't want to do that. And I don't know why it's not doing that for me today. And
are you sure it's the E. coli's fault?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
So E. coli is my least favorite at the moment. It's hard to pick a favorite bacteria. I don't know.
You like Pseudomonas?
I do like Pseudomonas. I'm partial to that.
Uh-huh.
But there's some other really cool...
You're working with microbacteria right now?
I work with microbacteria. One of my favorites, honestly, I really love Staphylococcus aureus.
Oh, yeah?
I think it's a cool one. It does some pretty cool stuff.
It just lives on our skin, mostly.
Yeah, it's on our skin. Anytime I've read anything about staph, maybe it's just the researchers in staph are really good at writing their papers. I don't know. It's a fun one. I like all bacteria. Pseudomonas will always be special to me. But anyway, I could talk about bacteria.
I know. Yeah. Maybe we should have an episode where you talk to us about bacteria.
Well, it's in the works.
It's in the works. Okay. All right. Well, lovely listener.
But there is a
get ready. Get ready because it's going to happen.
And there's even a bit of a teaser in the book about bacteria and kind of an episode we hope to do about extremophiles.
Oh, yes.
And bacteria that live in these, and I think we've mentioned it on the podcast before already, but that live in extreme environments and what that means for their proteins.
Yeah, like boiling hot springs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when you usually when you boil a protein, it completely unfolds.
Yeah.
And it's not able to be used. But somehow bacteria who have proteins can live in these super hot environments.
We should definitely talk more about them.
Yeah,
at some
we
point.
Should. And you can read about it in our book too.
Oh yes. Yes,
so,
definitely.
Yeah, this has been a long process in the book. There's been ups and downs. What was the most difficult, challenging, or frustrating moments in writing this book?
And writing,
I know
writing
mine,
a book?
Or in the whole process.
In the whole process.
I know mine.
Honestly, I have to say that I really wish that we had more time to do more illustrations.
Yeah.
I also think that, because of just the way that the book turned out, it's all black and white drawings.
Mm-hmm.
But your watercolor work is really amazing, and I wish that that would be part of the maybe second edition.
Oh.
Yeah, that would be nice. Just saying, I think that would have been really nice. But sometimes, I guess it's called like writer's block or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's really a thing called writer's block. I think
you
it's
don't?
Really a lack of motivation.
That sounded personal. That was a personal attack
just,
on me.
I know, on me, on me too, because I know I need to do it, but I just won't. And sometimes you just have to do it. You have to really remind yourself why you're doing this. And I think we agreed that we are doing this because it's fun. And, we're only going to do it because it's a lot.
That was the promise we made to each other.
Right.
Is that if any of the work that we've done together, but if it's not fun, we're not doing it.
Exactly.
And that doesn't mean that every moment is fun.
Yeah.
Also, tip for writer's block that I have found works really well for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. And and maybe this came from you. I don't remember a lot.
Is it
out.
Drink a beer?
No, but I do think you told me that.
Yes.
At some point too. I prefer to write by hand.
Yes.
I don't type when I'm writing.
No, I don't either.
I write everything by hand.
Yeah.
So I have piles and piles of notebooks from writing this book. I'll just start writing words. And sometimes that is just a list of swear words because I'm feeling frustrated that I can't write. Right. So it is literally just bleepity bleep bleep bleep.
And then when you get that out of your system, what happens?
Then it's, I don't know what to write. I don't know what to write. I'm feeling frustrated. I don't know what to write. I know I need to write about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I need to talk about the fact that this protein does this. And just kind of get a lot of that, cleaning your engine out or whatever.
Priming the pumps.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And so I do that all the time now when I'm trying to write anything. If I'm really stuck and especially when I know it is kind of almost like you're afraid to write something. Or you're just like, this is going to be bad. Just get all the bad stuff out. Like literally all the swear. I would just, I have so many favors. It's just.
Oh man. That's going to be in a museum one day.
Swear word. Because it is frustrating to feel like you are stuck. But sometimes the physical act of doing it can get you unstuck.
Yeah. And that's.
And maybe you told me that. I don't remember.
I think that's one of the tips that I got from someone about this a long time ago. And I honestly don't remember who it is. Otherwise I would give them credit.
Yeah.
But they said just. Shut everything out and just sit down and write continuously, nonstop. Don't lift the pencil. Again, write by hand for 10 or 15 minutes, nonstop. Just write. And if there's a word that you're trying to say and it doesn't come, just write scribbles and then skip over it and keep going because you want to put thoughts down to the paper and then you can go back and edit. But this whole idea of just sitting there staring at a flashing cursor just mocking you and taunting you, saying you don't have anything on that very clean Word document or Google Doc or whatever. That is just, it's not doing yourself any favors.
No.
But, I have to say it was really an enjoyable experience to just learn more about the things that we love and also just share with everybody and just talk about it in stories and just telling stories, which is a very powerful way to communicate with people.
Yeah, I think the funnest part was getting to pick what personal stories to write about and what things to share. You talk about your grandmother, your you're writing about coming to the United States, going back to Egypt, and mm-hmm. it's very moving. And I wrote about when my youngest child was a baby, like a newborn baby.
Yeah.
And that experience. Yeah, and my grandparents, one grandmother died from ALS and Bouguereg's disease, which is a protein-based disease. Yeah. And my other my grandfather passed away from Alzheimer's a couple of years ago. And it was a really beautiful experience to get to write about some things that are painful, some things that are joyful, some things that are just fun and silly. I wrote about catching fireflies with my kids on a July Indiana evening. So there's a wide range of things that we get to talk about.
I wrote about almost dying from frostbite.
You did write about that.
That was fun.
we wrote about my mentor, your mentor and colleague, Dr. Gretchen Anderson, mm-hmm. Who's a biochemist and passed away before we were at, but
yeah.
we had started to think about this book when she was still alive. So
yeah.
got to write about her and share what we love about her to more people.
Right.
We also talk a lot about like the history of different scientific discoveries, which I actually wasn't a huge fan of when our editor suggested we bring some of those stories in. And that probably ended up being one of my favorite parts.
Yeah, writing about the people that made these things happen.
Yeah, like just these, a lot of, this is my favorite thing about science, is a lot of the most groundbreaking discoveries were just accidents. or oops.
But oops, when people actually like paid attention to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't just like they made a mess and then they're like, wait, there's something there.
Yeah. I think those are my favorite stories. And actually that just happened in my lab this morning with another graduate student. Hi, Gus. I don't think he'll care. he was imaging something. So we're looking for proteins to see if they're there in different conditions. And it's like, nothing's showing up. I think something's wrong with the imager. He's like, wait, mm-hmm. what if there's actually just nothing there?
Oh.
Right? What if I didn't make a mistake, or what if this machine is not broken? Maybe this is actually the information and it would actually make sense. And, you know, he was about ready to close out the program and just like, I'm just throwing this away. And he's like, wait, what if there actually isn't anything there?
Yeah.
And what I'm looking for isn't there? And that's the answer.
That's a finding in of itself.
So I think getting to read about scientists. And I think it helped me become a little bit braver and bolder as a scientist to make mistakes and to not be so hung up on things. But I really enjoyed that part of the book. I really liked learning about, I talk about bioluminescence. So that's how fireflies glow in the dark. And the people who discovered bioluminescence and how it actually works. This dude would just grind up these clams that glowed mm-hmm. in the dark. And like boil them and see what happened. Mix it with two things, see what happened. Like just kind of really rudimentary idea experiments.
Just try a bunch of stuff and see what happens.
Just try a bunch of stuff and see what happens.
And that's the really cool thing, is about being methodical about playfulness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it's always cool to learn from other scientists, especially ones that maybe nobody actually knows about, right? I never learned about the name of the guy who discovered how bioluminescence works.
Yeah.
But now bioluminescence is indispensable for so much.
Right. For like cancer imaging, things like that. Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
And even people who went on to win Nobel Prizes for some of these discoveries, they were kind of accidental, but they just paid attention and were mindful and thought, maybe this is interesting. Maybe this isn't a mistake or something. Maybe this is actually something real going on. And I think that's super inspirational as a scientist, that you don't have to be super smart. You just have to make the right mistakes.
And just play with it.
And pay attention and to be mindful of the world around you. And not just be hyper-focused on getting the perfect data. I don't know if that makes sense. But that was one of my favorite parts of the book.
Well, so should I give away the ending of the book?
I suppose. If you want to spoil it, no.
That's spoiler. Spoiler alert.
Well, before you do that, I wanted to kind of briefly kind of mention the book has an arc, and I think talking about the ending does a disservice to the really intentional arc of this whole book, which the day we kind of came up with this will ever forever be a special day.
It was a special day because we really realized what we were actually doing without knowing that that's what we were doing. But there really was an arc to the whole thing because there are themes that are in the book. Mm-hmm. And the themes start with basically kind of like the beginning and then just kind of like birth and mm-hmm. growth and motion and rebellion and and awareness. And each one of those words really embodies the theme for each one mm-hmm. of these chapters. Mm-hmm. And then eventually goes to defiance and mm-hmm. defense. And then at the very end, well, not the very end, there's a chapter on death. And it's really all the things that kill us and all the diseases where proteins don't work. But then the last chapter is resurrection. And it's really about the future of proteins. Mm-hmm. And it's about what scientists are doing to reinvent proteins, to take the proteins that nature made, reinvent them, and create things that nature has never seen before, and then do amazing things, curing mm-hmm. diseases, finding and destroying pollutants, mm-hmm. breaking down plastics and capturing carbon dioxide and, just super cool stuff. And even making protein art. And mm-hmm. what was really nice is as we were writing about this and we were about to just submit the final draft for chapter.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
And we said, okay, this is it. We're done with this chapter about protein engineering. And especially we talk a little bit about how AI has had a role in protein engineering and in protein structure prediction. And then the 2024 Nobel Prize in Chemistry gets announced, and it's about protein engineering and about AI and mm-hmm. protein structure determination. And so that was really felt like that was really timely, and we just added that little bit.
I know, we got to add in a little sentence at the end of the book about, by the way,
this happened. This is why it's so important. Yeah. And here
that
we
are. That was special.
So we felt like it was really timely. And the book really goes all the way from birth to death to resurrection, and there's just these themes throughout each chapter.
They're all themes of human experience.
Exactly.
This was a long few years of writing this book.
Yes.
Lots of ups and downs. My least favorite part was getting the book got peer reviewed.
Yes.
Like a scientific research article would get peer reviewed. We got peer reviewed.
Yes.
That was not a fun process.
It's never a fun process, but it's so important.
It is very important. I'm grateful for all the feedback. Yes. But man, I was like, you've got to be kidding.
Yeah, because you don't want anything that you do to be criticized. But you also want everything that you do as a scientist to be criticized.
Yeah.
And but we're humans. And, we get our feelings hurt because people are like, I don't like the way that you wrote this. I'm like, but it's important.
I know. Well, do you remember the first round of peer reviews? Somebody emailed and said, I can't even get through the first 10 pages. I'm not going to review it.
I think they didn't get it. Yeah.
That was
upsetting.
That was probably one of the lower points. Yeah, and we don't know who these people are. It was blind peer review. But somebody said, I can't even get through it.
Yeah.
The authors clearly don't know what they're doing or talking about or something like that.
And maybe we don't.
Thankfully, other peer reviewers liked it, gave us really great feedback, hopefully made the book better. But I'm very proud of this book. And I thought I'd take this opportunity for us to get to talk about the process and talk about the book and why we wanted to do it and how lucky we are that we got this opportunity to write this book.
Yes.
So I think as we kind of wrap up this conversation, I would like to thank the people who helped us.
Yes.
Our agent, Luba, who agreed to represent us and helped us get our proposal and pitch ready. And really, and that was during COVID times
mm-hmm.
that she agreed to take us on and really helped make the book a million times better. And still continues to give us good advice and help us
always
from beginning to end. Our editor at Harvard University Press, Rachel Fields, wonderful, wonderful human who agreed to take a chance on two nobodies who just had a crazy idea. And again, helped make the book beautiful and better. And it's been immensely helpful.
And the peer reviewers.
Thank
you for taking the time to read the book and give us feedback, no matter how upset that made us. But it made the book better because that's the process.
And there's a whole other team of people that we haven't even met or know their names who've helped put the book together.
And also, I think we really owe the Burroughs Welcome Fund.
Yeah.
And the awesome people down there in North Carolina for giving us some space. They supported us to give us some space, to just some time
to write down there,
and to develop some workshops for science communication.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Research Corporation for Science Advancement with the Cottrell Scholars Award that really went to helping with the science communication part that we're doing.
Oh, and Kelsey. We have to thank Kelsey Ervick.
Yes.
Was the professor of the graphic memoir class that I took.
Of course.
And who inspired both of us to make art and to write. And we're hoping to have her on the podcast here shortly, so you'll get to hear from her.
Definitely.
Incredible artist, storyteller.
Yes.
Not a scientist, but a professor at Indiana University South Bend who has a great book. You should read it, called The Keeper, about the history of women's soccer, Title IX, women in sports, and her own experiences. So another huge inspiration for us as well in this process.
So go and get it. Go get it.
If you like to, want to, if, you know.
The Color of North, Harvard University Press.
And we're very grateful for everybody who's helped us along the way and for everybody who reads it and hopefully has nice things to say about it.
Hopefully.
May 13th. Good Lord.
You're just getting all your
name. I'm getting all turned around. May 13th.
2025.
You can get it on Amazon. So thanks for listening to us talk about this project. It's really special.
Thank you, Maggie.
Thank you, Shahir.
At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listeners, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.